Here in Wisconsin, we've been watching news of the wildfires in Maui in the aftermath of Hurricane Idalia from a distance. That can make us feel concerned, of course, for the people affected. We might also feel helpless in the face of so much destruction. But there are ways that you can contribute to disaster relief efforts. Our next guest is a disaster relief researcher. She has advice about what we can do as individuals to help affected communities in the aftermath of a catastrophic event. And she'll share her years of research on how we can learn from disasters and prepare as communities for the next one. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you ever been caught in the middle of a disaster, natural or otherwise? What kind of things helped you the most in the hours, days, and months afterwards? Do you contribute to disaster relief efforts? Do you have thoughts or questions about how communities can be ready for the next disaster, whatever it might be? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Tricia Wachtendorf is a professor of sociology and director of the Disaster Research Center at the University of Delaware. Tricia, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
First, can we talk a little bit about your work? You actually have gone to places in the aftermath of disasters, trying to figure out what works and what doesn't. Can you talk a little bit about what you're trying to do?
Sure. So our center has been studying disasters for 60 years, and there is a strong research community around this country that is interested not only in the aspects that lead to disaster, but how people respond, how organizations coordinate with each other, or some of the challenges associated with that, and things that we can do to recognize that people experience disasters in different ways.
For someone far from the disaster scene, as we've been in Wisconsin with the Maui wildfires, the hurricane in Florida, what are some of the most effective ways to make a contribution to help from afar?
In the disaster research and management communities, there's actually something that we often refer to as the second disaster, the influx of ad hoc goods into a disaster zone. And here's why. Helping a neighbor in a house fire is going to be very different than helping a community impacted by disaster. If my neighbor has a house fire, I might bring over clothes, but I know what sizes they have, and I can take back with me what they don't need. I can ask about their allergies if I'm taking them dinner, and I can ask them what they need right then and give it to them in an hour or in a day. That is strikingly different for a community impacted by disaster. There can be a delay in transportation, difficulty storing goods. And often, unfortunately, what we see is the influx of clothes, goods that are not sorted or damaged. People might get supplies that they needed in the first day or two, but by the time it gets there, it's a week or so later, and it ends up being a huge logistical challenge for them.
So what's my best bet, as opposed to, you know, going through my clothes closet and seeing what I can give up, or going through the canned food in the pantry? What would be a more effective way to give to help?
It's much more effective to give a cash donation to an organization you trust, either a national organization, or even in looking at some of the community groups that may routinely help in an area. It could be a school, it could be a daycare, it could be a social service organization, a community group. Those kinds of organizations that we look to in our neighborhoods all the time, those are going to struggle when a disaster happens as well. And those are the people who know the residents the best, who can step in and to provide assistance. One thing that we know as well is that it can be a little bit difficult for people to give cash if they're tight on a budget. So one of the interesting cases that we saw after the Haiti earthquake, I came across a parking lot sale by a faith-based organization. They at the time recognized that their parishioners didn't have a lot of cash to give. They were told that giving clothes would be a bad idea after the Haiti earthquake. And so they had a parking lot sale. They took those clothes, they had sold it back to other people in the community. And then rather than pushing those supplies onto a country that wasn't able to accept it or didn't need it at the time or would cost money to send it there, they actually sent them the cash that they earned from that sale. So there's sometimes creative ways that we can recognize it can be difficult to give cash, but at the same time, recognizing the real needs of those impacted communities.
I know sometimes when I've wanted to give after a disaster, there's an urge in my head to say, okay, I want to make sure this money goes to the people who just had that hurricane. I want it earmarked for that and that only. Does that make life difficult for relief organizations if I try to do that?
It actually does, especially when there are several disasters that happen one on top of the other. You might recall back when Hurricane Harvey happened, there were several other hurricanes that occurred later. A lot of people gave after Hurricane Harvey and earmarked those particular donations. But then that makes it difficult for an organization to say, look, we have enough here, but this is a community that really needs help. We can't spend it, though. We can't direct those dollars to those in need because someone earmarked it for one particular hurricane and not the other. If it's great if you want to indicate your preference that it goes to disaster relief, but it's really important to give flexibility for those organizations so they can shift gears and respond to people's actual need.
Talking to Tricia Wachtendorf, Professor of Sociology, Director of the Disaster Research Center at the University of Delaware, talking about how we can best help people who experience disasters far away, how to prepare for disasters in any community as well. And you could join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions for our guest, your experiences, whether it's philanthropy to help people after a disaster, whether you've participated in a local effort to be ready for tornadoes, floods, fires, you name it, join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Tricia, let's talk about preparing communities for potential disasters. What are some of the things that, again, everyday people can get involved in their own community?
Yeah, on the community level, there's often a community emergency response team that operates out of your local or your state emergency management agency. Those are great ways to get involved before a disaster strikes, consider the kinds of skills that you might have, and really get integrated into that network. If a disaster happens, there are volunteer organizations active in disasters that have a seat at the table in emergency operation centers. Sometimes those are good organizations to reach out to. If we are in our own community, that is a situation where we often know those needs better than anyone. One of the things that we know as well that you're more likely to be saved after an earthquake by your neighbors, by your family and friends who know you're in a building, compared to someone coming from a great deal of distance away. That holds true on all fronts. We have skills that we have resources that we might not think of as being important in a disaster response. We did some work looking at the boat evacuation after 9/11, and there were tugboat operators, ferry boat operators who came in, who saw a need, who had a vessel, and were able to evacuate by boat where there was no plan in place. We see the same thing with the Cajun Navy time and time again. So thinking about the skills that you have, the connections that you have in your neighborhood, and ways that you can tie into those organizations that are helping so that you can get the information about where those needs are.
I wonder, those boat rescues were great things. I wonder about, you know, the temptation like, oh, I want to rush in and help people. Well, if I don't have skills, if I don't know what I'm doing, am I just making the situation worse? How do people self-evaluate in that way, whether to stay away and that's going to help more, or I can actually help here?
You're absolutely right that there's a tough balance to strike. It is best when we are acting in some capacity where we have skills. You certainly wouldn't want me taking a boat out to save anyone, because I would just get my own self in trouble. But at the same time, if I am operating in areas that I have skills in, if I'm an educator and I'm used to working with small children, who better to potentially volunteer at a shelter to provide some assistance? Again, that is where some of those organizations that coordinate volunteers, those volunteer organizations active in disasters, is really important. And especially if you're coming to an area that you're not from. There are going to be aspects of the culture. Disasters can change the geography, the way you get around. So if you are just converging on an area and you're unfamiliar with it, and you don't have a connection to help you get integrated, that can pose a lot of challenges.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Chris is with us in Wazika. Chris, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Chris?
Well, we've had two disasters that have happened here locally. In 2013 and 2019, we had flooding that was quite severe, and I helped out with that. I think we ended up with 5.5 feet of water in our basement in 2013. And then I've been active in Civil Air Patrol. I'm retired now. But we did air, ground, search and rescue, disaster relief, looking for missing persons, stuff like that. And I did that for 25 years.
Wow. Chris, thank you so much for sharing that experience and for all the work you've done. Tricia, what are some of the contacts we can make, the connections we can make now before a disaster? We might not all be in Civil Air Patrol, but so we can contribute like Chris did when the need arises.
Well, again, some of the connections are through CERT teams. As Chris mentioned, as being retired in a certain capacity, there are sometimes organizations like the Medical Reserve Corps that takes in volunteers with a medical background. There's other ones as well, where if you have a skill, they'll really match you around a particular area of expertise. Building those connections in our community. So I'm not sure if Chris's contacts know the wonderful expertise brought to the table, but knowing somebody who knows someone else can be really essential. It might be knowing somebody who has a generator and you didn't know that, but your friend does, or somebody you serve on a community group or your kid's little league team remembers you saying something. Building those connections is really valuable.
Chris, thanks a lot for sharing that experience. We're talking to Tricia Wachtendorf, professor of sociology, director of the Disaster Research Center at the University of Delaware. She's here to tell us how we can help communities affected by disaster, how we can prepare for the worst in our own neighborhoods. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a plan in place for when disaster comes? Are you or have you been a volunteer on some kind of disaster response team? What questions do you have for our guest? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Tricia Wachtendorf, professor of sociology, director of the Disaster Research Center at the University of Delaware, talking to her about disaster response, how we can contribute as individuals, how to prepare for future disasters. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your experiences, maybe your questions for our guest, 800-642-1234. Tricia, before we go back to our callers, wanted to bring up the issue of communication. There are always questions about, you know, how local governments and others can communicate risk to the public and when the public should sit up and take notice and say, oh yeah, I'm the public. I should be listening to this message. What do we know about what works best?
One of the key things to keep in mind for communities is to use multiple ways of reaching the public. Some of us are active on social media, but is that social media Facebook or is it Instagram or is it TikTok? Some of us are more likely to get our information from radio or television or print news. And then there's others who are really relying on, let's say, leaders in their faith community or community groups or government officials. So using a multi-prong approach is important, and making sure that that information is consistent so that someone isn't hearing one thing from one person and then reading something else that is different. That consistency, being specific, being clear about what people should do, those are key aspects in communication.
Let's bring on another caller at 800-642-1234. Austin is with us in Lafarge. Austin, hi.
Hi there. I just wanted to share a great avenue for people that are maybe a little nerdy or like to practice with electronics and technology, that amateur radio, ham radio, is a great skill to acquire and get involved with your local clubs and local disaster relief groups. it's well documented during Hurricane Katrina, 9/11, and dozens and dozens of cases of ham radio being the backbone of critical communication infrastructure. And it's a great hobby otherwise, when you're not participating in things like that. So it's a sort of a dying hobby, but would certainly be a great way for young people to practice their science and technology, and also learn a neat way to be involved in times like that.
Austin, thanks a lot for the suggestion. That's not my particular brand of nerdery, but my dad and my younger brother were big into ham radio for a while. And Tricia, I think about that and I worry about the decline of amateur radio, because sometimes if the internet is down, if our power is down, that is a way for people to communicate across long distances.
Yeah, and I don't have one either. But I think your caller makes a really good point about helping doesn't necessarily mean being on the ground where a disaster happens, that there are ways to get involved and provide assistance, be it through ham radio operation, which he's absolutely right, can play a really important role in disaster response and communication. By actually setting up a communication system through various social media, or setting up a website for an organization. There's lots of remote activity that can actually be much more helpful to those on the ground than joining them in person.
Austin, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Tricia, that reminds me of the risk of social media misinformation about disasters. I think there have always been false rumors that follow any major disaster. They are super in your face on social media. Pictures that are not accurate representations of what's going on, rumors of disease outbreaks, things like that. How big a problem is bad information spreading about any particular disaster?
It is a challenge. It primarily we see a lot of it in not the immediate time period, but you know, a couple of hours or a couple of days or weeks out. What can also happen is information that was correct at some time for some disaster gets recycled for another disaster. So the image that you see might actually be from a hurricane, but it's from a hurricane from 3 years ago, or a situation that emerged is not from this event in this area, but it's from something else. Sometimes that is misinformation, someone trying to cause trouble. But a lot of times it's also this idea of disinformation that you talk about, where people are well-intended. They're trying to share information. They haven't checked the source of it. And it can lead to real challenges in people trying to make sense about what to do next. Making sure that if you are sharing information that you've checked it before you do that is really important to help others.
Let's go back to our callers. Vivian is with us in Green Bay. Vivian, hi.
Hi. I've been involved in some minor disasters, but the commonality was that folks were looking for someone to lead. They didn't know what to do. Time passed. One was a medical situation, fortunately not deadly, but minutes passed. No one seemed to take hold and coalesce the group. So I think volunteers with some knowledge can fill that role unexpectedly anywhere.
Vivian, thanks for the call. Trisha, are there ways we can be prepared to step up and help out and bring people together in that way?
I think that part of it is this combination of people who are experienced in disasters or experienced in the area that they're working with, working alongside people who might be engaging in a degree of surge capacity, they don't know what to do, but they have something that they can offer in that moment. So this combination of recognizing where your skills are and being willing to step up to share that with others. Sometimes the person who knows the most is kind of unassuming. In a disaster, someone might show up in their sweatpants and a t-shirt. They're not necessarily uniformed or looking like a leader, but to understand and really keep an open mind that some of those individuals might bring a wealth of expertise to that response.
Thanks for that call, Vivian. Tricia, one thing I wanted to get into in your research, you talk about social vulnerability as a factor in how people are affected by disasters. How does that work? It may seem obvious, but who is more vulnerable? How can we help deal with that vulnerability?
Sometimes when a disaster happens, we have this assumption that the hurricane or the tornado or the earthquake or the environmental spill doesn't care about our demographics, doesn't care about who we are. And that might be the case, but the community that we live in, the sort of vulnerabilities that we have, do make a huge difference in how we experience that particular disaster event. If my power goes out for a week, I might lose the goods in my fridge. I might be eating a lot of ice cream with my kids. It's just in the hours afterwards. But in general, I'm going to be okay. That is a very different circumstance if I rely on refrigerated medication, if I'm in an electric wheelchair, if I'm on dialysis and need to get into an appointment, if I'm in a bed that requires assistance for me to raise it and lower it to get out of bed, that won't be possible if the power goes out. Thinking about how also that vulnerability changes over time as we engage in preparedness for our own household. Was there a new baby in the home? That's going to make a difference about what kind of supplies that you need to have together in order to take care of this new member of your household. Do you provide assistance to an elderly parent who lives across town? Is somebody else relying on you? Even thinking about our pets. We might have a carrier where we're able to take one dog at a time to the vet. But if we have to evacuate, like we saw in Maui, very suddenly, very quickly, are we able to get all of our pets out at the same time and transport them? So understanding how our vulnerability, our challenges routinely become exacerbated, get worse in a disaster, will help us understand how we can prepare our own homes.
Tricia, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Tricia Wachtendorf, professor of sociology and director of the Disaster Research Center at the University of Delaware. We talked to her about disaster relief, recovery, and preparedness.